Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
We have a visual.
Here's John Williams.
Yes, this will require you to imagine you've seen television before. Hi, it's John Williams. It's 109. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. I'm watching people with umbrellas and some without walk in a light rain, which is what I was doing earlier today. We may not see sunshine in 75 again until next year, but boy, what a nice run we had, huh? Friday fab, Saturday fab, Sunday not so much, but boy, oh boy, that was a nice at least first half of the weekend. And lots to do on the show for you today. We'll start with just a little Justin Timberlake music in 3, 2, 1, woof.
I can't wait till I get you on the floor, good looking.
I remember when this song first came out, I just loved it. I still do. And I haven't heard it in a while. I'll bet you Justin Timberlake music sales go up this week and for the next few weeks. So Justin Timberlake's in the news, of course, because the NFL has announced okay, all right, you can come back. But you'd better behave, mister. You'd better be on your best behavior, fella, or we're not going to let you back. Maybe the most talented person in America, Justin Timberlake, has been invited back to the NFL's Super Bowl game. He will be part of the halftime show. I think that's a great idea. I hadn't thought about the fact that he was part of the wardrobe malfunction story for a long time. That's kind of history. And the fact that he has not performed at the Super Bowl since then kind of took me by surprise, because it just seems to me like Justin Timberlake is such a perfect fit. I don't know how often you're supposed to be invited, but he's being asked back. And so 13 years later, actually it'll be 14 because it happened in 2004, and the Super Bowl will be in 2018, so I guess 14 years later, he gets to come back and do the Super Bowl halftime
show.
Now,
is he going to pay them? Right? Didn't they go through that in the past?
Oh, my God. Well, I'm sorry, what do you mean? But oh, that's right. Who gets paid?
Like the NFL was expecting, had asked that the artist pay them or something?
Right. Yeah. That was a year or two ago. And who was the artist that they said should pay for the opportunity to perform for them? Which is just so very NFL of the NFL,
right,
isn't it?
I don't remember who it was.
Yeah, I don't.
I'll look that up.
Ella,
I'm curious.
Find out who the person was that did the thing where the NFL wanted them to pay them.
Yes, sir.
I want to say like Katy Perry or something.
That sounds right. Ding, 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 ding. I don't know. Ella, find out if it's Katy Perry.
Okay.
Boy, the world has sure changed in 14 years, eh? I mean, if you think about it, in the last, 18 months or so, I don't know where your time horizon is, but we've had a president who bragged about groping women. Harvey Weinstein is out. Bill O'Reilly, we've discovered, just to give you a sense of two completely different worlds, Bill O'Reilly settles several cases of sexual harassment, settles the cases.
He's paid more than some countries' GDP, hasn't he?
For one woman alone, he gave $32 million. And I don't know what number jumps out at you more. The fact that he or his company, through him, wrote a check to a woman for $32 million, or that after that, they then sign him to a $100 million deal. That tells you that we don't care as much as the money we can make. We don't care. We just don't care is the mantra. The president gets to brag about it. I don't need to give you all the examples of late of men behaving badly and all of us living in a world where that's de rigueur. I'm not even sure I said that right or used that properly. But if you go back 14 years, for 9/16ths of a second, a woman's pasty-covered right breast was exposed on national television, and for that crime, the Earth stopped orbiting on its axis or spinning on its axis. I mean, it's insane when you look back at what happened a decade and a half ago. And so let's. February 1st, 2004. Even before, this is from a Rolling Stones story written on the 10-year anniversary. Some of this stuff is utterly fascinating. You think, oh, I remember that. Do you remember? I do better, perhaps, than you do because I worked at a radio station at the time. But what happened as a result of Justin Timberlake pulling the sort of bustier and bra off of Janet Jackson, what happened as a result of that had ripples through the broadcast industry for years. Programs had to
Did
be.
Did you say ripples?
I know. I wish I hadn't. Had to be tape delayed. Words were excised. Careers were marginalized. So let's go to the Rolling Stone piece. Even well, let's just play the audio of the event itself. Here's what it sounded like. And then, so that's all I got for you. But at the end of the song, he reaches over, he grabs her top. He's supposed to pull the black leather top off to reveal her red bra underneath. Instead, he gets all of it, and you see her right breast for 9/16ths of a second. And the argument then forever will be, was it done intentionally or not? But if you ask yourself, well, did they do it on purpose or not? Then you have to say, well, who were they who wanted that to happen? Surely not the NFL. That's the No Fun League. CBS did not want that, had no intention for that to happen. Did the producers of the show want that to happen? Maybe not, maybe. But, I mean, really, what's the upside for them to end with that bang? Are they going to get invited back to do something if they go against the league and CBS? No. So that leaves Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake. Do you think Janet Jackson wanted that to happen to her? Did she want on international television this guy to reach over, rip off her top, and show her right breast? I doubt that. That leaves Justin Timberlake. He all along has denied that it was intentional. Rolling Stone wrote, even before the Janet incident, Kid Rock. So here's, they make the point that the reason that we were hypersensitive may have been what happened before. Kid Rock riled up the TV audience by wearing sleeveless Stars and Stripes poncho during his portion of the halftime show. I remember that. Many viewers complained to the FCC that Rock's wardrobe constituted desecration of the American flag. Sexually suggestive dance moves, courtesy of fellow halftime performers Nelly and Diddy, may have also helped put prude viewers on the edge before the incident. Producers opted to have Jackson remain on stage for the Justin Timberlake halftime closing spot. She had performed along with others. They say, you stay out there and you two can do this one song, dance around together to close it out with a big bang. On the closing Bet I'll Have You Naked, you see his approach to Jackson's bustier is stilted and unsure, although a natural righty. He watches as his left hand makes the crucial grab towards Jackson's wardrobe and pulls on the cue by the end of this song. For 9/16ths of 1 second, millions of viewers see Janet's bare breast and its strange star-shaped nipple shield before Jackson realizes what has happened and covers herself up. Timberlake, red lace in his left hand, looks appalled as producers cut away. No one remembers the second half of the game. Patriots won. Brady was the MVP. Whatever. February 1st, same day. Jackson immediately flies out of Houston following her performance and before the Super Bowl even ends. Jackson's spokesperson, so she's out of there. Like, I don't know if she knows what people saw or what was happening. This was before Twitter, right? If she was on her flight, she would have been able to follow the tweets, but she wasn't and it didn't exist. So Jackson's spokesperson calls the reveal a malfunction of the wardrobe. It was not intentional. Timberlake was supposed to pull away the bustier and leave the red lace bra. 1 week later, February 8th, just days after the Super Bowl, it's reported that over 200,000 viewers had contacted the FCC to complain about Jackson's performance. Court documents later revealed that over 540,000 people filed complaints with the FCC about the incident. although that number was inflated by conservative and watchdog groups mass calling the commission. Later that month, CBS and MTV's parent company, Viacom, are angered that an unannounced addition to the Super Bowl performance has now cost them all future halftime shows. So because the NFL's like, okay, CBS, Viacom, thank you very little. And now they're upset because of what this is costing them. But the person that paid the dearest price for this is a genuinely sad part of this story. In a minute. I'm bringing sexy back. I suppose they'll try and tone it down a little bit. I mean, people will just be looking for any innuendo, any little malfunction, anything too provocative. But Justin Timberlake is coming back, and I'm really glad about that. Especially when I go back and read this story, Steve. It's just, like, striking how, I mean, you think this happened in 1953 or something.
Right.
How strident we were.
All I know is I was at a party, I missed it, and then they didn't show that replay. They showed a replay of every snap of that night.
You bet. You bet.
Not that snap.
Well, do you know, okay, so this is, I'll just skip around on the story, but since you mentioned it, because I was at a party too. I was at Bob Westrick's. We were watching the game. It's the Bing Bam 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 show. I was uncomfortable with Kid Rock's American flag poncho. I'm enough of an old school guy that I wasn't appreciating the thrusting on stage. And I don't know, I'm reaching for a Dorito at the end of this song. I'm reaching for a Dorito when it happened. And the woman sitting next to me, she goes, oh, well, thanks a lot for that. And I look up and it was gone. I said, what happened? She told me. I said, wow, no replay, no replay, no replay.
I mean, come on. And then it was, I don't think, and there wasn't... YouTube and all wasn't around as much either, so I don't think I've ever seen it. That and the MASH finale. Two great moments in TV history.
So 3 years ago, about this incident, on its anniversary, Rolling Stone wrote the following. A young software programmer at PayPal named Jawed Karim is unable, like Steve Bertrand, to find any video of the Jackson Super Bowl performance online. Frustrated in his attempts to find the footage, Karim and some friends create a venue where people can easily upload and share video. Thanks to the scandal, in 2005, what is born, Steve?
YouTube?
YouTube is born as a result.
Wow. How about that?
A year later, Google buys the site from them for, take a guess, take a guess.
I have no idea.
Elif, how much did they pay 1 year later for YouTube after its creation?
Am I guessing or am I looking this up?
Oh, that's right. Elif, guess. Don't look up because I have it in front of me.
$8 million.
$8 million is low. One more guess. Bertrand, how much did they pay for YouTube?
$2.3
billion. $1.65 billion.
Holy.
They give them $1.65 billion 1 year later because they were trying to find the video of Janet's breast. Karim worked on the code that became YouTube. The rest of America was looking for alternative methods to rewind and rewatch and reconcile what they had just witnessed.
So Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson are the parents of YouTube.
Totally true.
Wow.
By the way, as a result of Jackson's split-second slip, TiVo subscriptions jumped exponentially, and the acronym TVR and DVR became household words. Because if you were lucky enough to be taping it somehow, you would have been able to see it. Wouldn't have been able to share it. Oh, wait, now there's a YouTube. But she then gets blackballed. Every corner of television has an opinion about Nipplegate, but none do as hilariously as David Letterman. The Late Show host relishes the opportunity to exacerbate his employer, CBS's red-faced moment, devoting a week's worth of opening monologues and top 10 lists to the infamous 9/16 of a second. Janet, wearing a revealing red dress, finally visits Letterman's show on March 29th, 2004. Despite telling him, I don't want to revisit the Super Bowl incident, Letterman asks a barrage of questions about it. And then he says, how's Tito? You can see him doing that.
Okay. So women in the workplace and stuff like that, we talk about that. It is interesting to me that he's come back before she is.
Oh, my God.
And, I mean, I think
so
he's,
true.
He's more relevant and doing more, I think, now than she is. But I still think it would be more of an outcry if we brought back the mom of you two than just the dad.
Unlike this year, where CBS's broadcast of the Grammys precedes the Super Bowl, in 2004, CBS had the Super Bowl scheduled prior to the Grammys, where Jackson was recruited to present a Luther Vandross tribute. However, following the Super Bowl and the uproar, CBS rescinded their invitation. They uninvited her to appear at the Grammys. Timberlake was not only allowed to attend the ceremony, he won a pair of awards. He used his acceptance speech to apologize again, but he rips her top off, and she gets blackballed by the company, is never invited back, and she is asked not to appear at the Grammy Awards.
Okay, so I'll say it here right now.
Yeah?
She's going to be part of the show.
Oh, wow, nice. Nice, nice, nice. I like that thinking.
Uh-huh.
So maybe she appears, and then they're both of them are singing and walking towards each other on the stage.
And she rips his shirt off.
That would be a fair turnabout's fair play.
Okay, I totally could see that happening.
Yeah, boy, oh boy. But then somebody somewhere with a, you know, starched white shirt's going to go,
I'm not comfortable with where this is going.
Well, no, she could just share the stage and they can sing together.
Yeah, but see, but then she's something. You know, shame on you if you rip my bustier off once, but shame on me if you rip it off twice.
No, there's no ripping. There's just going to
be part of the
show.
I don't want them anywhere in the same stadium.
But ripping a guy's T-shirt off is much different from ripping a girl's bra off.
Did you Google search that out?
And where's the equity
no.
in that? By the way, did you look up the thing that we asked you to look up?
Which thing?
What was the thing I was barking at?
It's right in front of you.
Remember.
Where's what?
I printed it. It was Katy Perry, Coldplay, and Lady Gaga.
All wanted to, and the NFL wanted them to pay for the privilege of performing at the Super Bowl. How very NFL of them. 129. Mary Schmeek's column yesterday in the Chicago Tribune was the stuff of great writing, reporting, and the most sensitive of storytelling. It was Matt versus the Monster, about a young man who battled his addiction over and over and over again, drained his mother's bank account. Mary and that man are going to be in our studio in a little bit. Sam Panionovich, meanwhile, is on the phone, our WGN sports guy. Hi, Sam. How are you?
I'm good, John. Yourself?
Why aren't you in the studio? I like it when you sit next to me.
Guilt tripping already. Just when we got started, I thought we were going to have a nice little chat, and you got a guilt trip right away.
All right, let's do this. How well did you do picking five NFL games over the weekend?
2-2. So it was a weird week. I think the top 10 picks in the contest in Vegas, the Super Contest, the top 10 picks went 0-10. So it was a really weird week. A lot of the favorites won. You know, I like to pick the underdogs, but 2-2. And actually, I was shocked to, when you look at the stat sheet and the Bears and Panthers game, I was shocked that we did pick the Bears, and we haven't lost a Bears game yet this season. I was shocked that the Bears won that game when you look at that stat sheet. It's amazing because they pretty much lost in every category but turnovers, and they win that game 17-3. It was ugly. It wasn't pretty, but we got it done.
Yeah, let's just quickly say Sam is in a national contest. He and I have been sort of putting our heads together and picking five games against the spread each week that we're most confident in. By that, I mean that Sam is most confident in. And if he is in the top three in this national contest, he wins $1 million or $72,000. But a million's the top prize, right? A million?
Yeah, a million. The top 50 actually plays. Top 50 spots actually get money. I think that ends up being the top 3%. So if you're in the top 3% of 2,700, you make the cash. We have a 2-2 record this week, and we've got the Washington Redskins tonight plus five. So we could still end up with 3-2, and we'd be right there. We're in the top 300 right now.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yep.
And yet I feel so bad because I told you to bet against the Vikings, and the Vikings won and beat the spread. So
you told me to bet against the Cowboys, and the Cowboys won 40-10.
Oh, I knew that. I thought I advised you on the Vikings game, too.
No, we didn't touch Vikings game.
Okay, good. And then on the Bears game, how happy should Bears fans be? Like, we lost that game. We have nothing. We have nothing to be happy about. I mean, obviously, we realize now we have a terrific defense, but we sort of knew that. And you can't win if you can't score some points, and we still can't score any points. So I'm not so sure that that was a good game for the Bears.
It was the first time in a long time a team has won with only 5 first downs, that a team has won with only 4 pass completions.
4.
I mean, you look at Mitch Trubisky's numbers, and everybody talks about, well, it was time for Mitch Trubisky. He was 4 for 7 for 107 yards. Now, he didn't turn the ball over.
Wait, he only attempted – a starting NFL quarterback only attempted 7 passes in the whole game?
He attempted 7, completed 4 for 107 yards.
Well, he's got that going for him. But, I do not remember us being – I mean, I know we run and run well. We didn't do anything well this game offensively, but I didn't. Why didn't we pass more?
I really think that John Fox thinks that running the ball is the way to victory, and he actually echoed that after the game. He said, "Good things happen to teams that run the ball and dominate the clock." Issue is, the Bears didn't really run the ball all that well. They had 68 rushing yards, and they didn't dominate the clock.
No.
I mean, if you look at a 60-minute football game, the Panthers had the ball for 38 minutes. The Bears had the ball for 21. The only thing you can take from this game is that the defense continues to show up. This is a top-10 defense, and you and I talked about this before the season. They're strong up front. The linebackers are coming along, and I think the secondary has really shown you a lot, especially rookie safety Eddie Jackson, who came from Alabama. And Nick Saban, when Jackson was drafted by the Bears, he said, this guy has a nose for the football. He knows where it is. He knows how to find it. He knows how to take it away. And Jackson is the first player in the history of the NFL to have 2 return touchdowns in a single game over 75 yards. One of them was a fumble. The other one was an interception. He's just making plays all over the field. So that was good.
How long has he been in the league?
4 games.
Yeah, this is his rookie season. So think about that. A guy who has 4 games under his belt outscored our offense. Our offense in its entirety, right?
He outscored the offense and the entire Panthers team.
Okay. So
Eddie Jackson had 4. Well, I guess Eddie Jackson had 14 points.
Right.
The Bears offense had 3. The Panthers offense had 3.
So who do we play next? Has that been published? Is that out in the newspapers yet?
The schedule? Like,
yeah.
Who the Bears play next?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's set in stone in, like, July. They play the Saints next week in New Orleans.
Okay, so then they beat Green Bay, right?
Right, yeah. We had Green Bay in the Super Contest. We were getting 5.5 points. The Packers were winning or covering for 56 minutes. And then New Orleans had a gimme touchdown in the last couple of minutes, and we didn't get that cover. But, yeah, Green Bay without Aaron Rodgers, they're just so bad. I mean, it shows you how important that Aaron Rodgers is to a football team. He may be the most important player to his team. I'd say you look at Aaron Rodgers and then Tom Brady as the 2 most important players to their team. If they don't have that player, the team is completely different, and it's not even close.
Yeah, no kidding. Hold on a second. I'm getting a phone call.
You should take that.
Nah, I'm not sure who that is. You know, if the name does not appear on your screen, it means it's not somebody you've frequently spoken to. And therefore,
you ever get the calls from a number? It's 1-2-3-4-5-6-7-8-9. You ever get those?
No. I get unknown.
I get them all the time.
What is 1-2?
I have no idea who it is.
What does 1-9 mean?
I have no idea. I never pick it up.
Oh, pick up on those. You know, when my wife's phone rings unknown, I pick it up, and she looks at me and rolls her eyes. She goes, oh, for God's sakes, what are you doing? Well, it's somebody calling. God bless them. They're making an effort. Let's find out what they want to say. I'll get back to you on that. Oh, 1-2-3-4-5-6-7-8-9. Never seen that. So the Bears are now, like, in second place in the division, right?
They're actually in last. They're 3-4, but they're only 2 games behind the Vikings.
And like I said, we're in last place, if I'm not mistaken.
No, yeah, the Bears are in last. They're 3-4, but then you have the Lions at 3-3, the Packers at 4-3. So I would not be surprised by any means if the Bears win 7 or 8 games and finish in second place. I don't think they catch Minnesota because Minnesota's cooking. This seems to be their year, which is ironic because you just left Minnesota. I think 7 or 8 wins are in their grasp because this defense continues to impress. And I think Adam Hoge tweeted this out yesterday. He was talking about how he was talking with somebody that scouted the Bears, or he was a Bears coach or some
coach. About the Super Bowl defense?
that they have a Super Bowl defense. All right, right.
Yeah,
well, they have
that.
A high school offense. So you need to kind of you have to bridge that gap a little bit. So that's what I'm going to say. I mean, we knew coming in this was a transition year. You
what?
Know, when you draft the rookie quarterback.
Wait, hold on a second, Sam. See, Bertrand needs to say something.
Which high school, yes. Sam?
Mantino.
Oh, that's not good.
I was going to say, because I've seen some high school offenses that could probably put up six against the Panthers over the weekend. You know, the game that or the observation I had that we were second place evidently is not borne out by the facts. But what was surprising and pleasant to see was that Northwestern in their division is in second place.
Yeah, nice win over Iowa. That was at home. The Cats came back. They had no points at half, so they look like the Bears offense or at least one half. But they found the Thunder in the second half, and they started to run the ball behind Justin Jackson, and they win 17-10 in overtime.
Yeah.
So it was a big game because, you know, you got to stay above 500, and the Cats were 3-3. They win that game. They're now 4-3. They're tied with Nebraska at 2-2, and then Wisconsin, of course, the cream of the crop in the West, the Big Ten West. They're 4-0. They haven't lost a game yet this year. They're 7-0 altogether. But, yeah, Northwestern's right there. They should win 6, 7, 8 games, and they should go to a nice bowl game.
Who wins, Northwestern or the Bears, if we get to have Northwestern? I don't know.
The Bears. That's a silly question.
I know. I'm sorry. Strike it, Your Honor. All
well,
right.
That was that old question a couple years ago. Would Alabama beat the Jaguars?
I know,
no.
I know. Yeah,
because it's a bunch of grown men against a bunch of 18, 19, and 20-year-olds.
I have a son who always gets annoyed at that. Like, you take the worst NBA team, and then you have the NCAA champion play the worst team in the NBA. And, you know, Grant's always going, no, don't you remember all of the guys on the worst NBA team were the best of the college class? That's how they got there. So it wouldn't even be close.
Right. Who would host a better radio show, King John or the best college radio host?
Exactly. Let's just leave it.
Exactly.
Steve, your mic's not on, so you really don't have anything
again,
to say right
so
now.
Mantino High School, what's the college?
Joliet Community College.
Mm. Joliet Community College. That's Joliet Junior College. They are the Wolves. And under Jerry Yost, I was in 1980 their field goal kicker. I would appreciate it if you would remember that.
Is that the season you kick every punt forward?
You still can't catch 5 punts, John. We all know that.
No, we had an incident in my high school career where some of the kicks that I engaged in did not finish in front of the point where my foot came in contact with the ball.
Some of them?
And Steve thinks that that's really funny.
No, I thought it's one hilarious. Was funny. Several's kind of, well, that's kind of sad.
I will just tell you this. So there we were playing Chicago Kennedy. We were the number one ranked junior college team in the United States of America. We were playing at Kennedy, though. We didn't enjoy the bus ride. There was some mold in the air conditioning unit on the bus. When we get out of the bus, we go in, and it's kind of a soggy night. And we should have been able to handle Kennedy. I mean, Joliet Junior College football team, famous and stacked. We came out like a Big Ten team. We would have almost 100 kids in uniform, and a lot of them would go on to play Division I football. But for various reasons, grades, prison sentences, they were playing at the junior college at the time. I was their field goal kicker. I was a really good field goal kicker. I could kick the ball off 60 yards. I could put it in the end zone. I could kick a 40-yard field goal with relative ease. But all of us hoped that it would not come down to my ability to kick the field goal. Are you still with me, Sam? Is this line still on?
I'm here. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. So, lo and behold, in the second half of the game, is tied. We need a field goal. And the coach, like, you know, he can't believe any more than I can that these words are coming out of his mouth. He says, Williams, in. What happened next is not my fault. I'll have to finish that story in a minute. Sam Panionovich from WGN Radio Sports called in and asked me to tell a story about my college football kicking career. Are you still on the phone, Sam?
I'm here.
It was actually in 1979. I'll finish the story this way. So, we're number one team in the United States for junior.
Did it happen in 1979, or did you start telling the story in 1979?
So, it was 1979.
And the Joliet Junior College Wolves are the number one ranked team in the United States of America under then head football coach Jerry Yost. Bill Foss was our defensive coordinator. I was on the special teams unit, and nobody knew that. I was the field goal kicker and punter for the squad, and I was pretty damn good. I could really kick the football pretty hard. In a game against Chicago Kennedy, as we were sporting our number one ranking, and they were not, we go into their place. In a critical moment in the game, we need a field goal. The coach throws me in there. I go out into the rain-soaked field, and as the ball is snapped to our wide receiver, he places the ball down for me to kick it flat. He lays it like a hard-boiled egg on its side. As I approached the ball, I realized this was not ideal, but this was no time to quibble. I kicked the ball as hard as I could, and at its peak, it achieved a height of approximately 22 inches. It bounced off the backside of one of our front guys and ricocheted in the opposite of the intended direction. Now, Steve, are you happy with that story?
I love it every time I hear it.
Yeah. So that's what happened to me, and as we came off the field, the coach literally picked me up by the front of my shoulder pads. I wasn't one of our larger players. He picks me up off the ground, and I happen to be taller than him. Just imagine the visual. And he says, "What did you do?" And I was thinking, well, when the ball was snapped, but he wasn't interested in what happened out there. He was just venting on me, and I thought, well, that's his right. It doesn't bother me anymore. I mean, I don't think he's ever heard my version of these events, but I've moved past it, Sam, and I want you to know that I'm a healed and well person now.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
You sent me a picture of Jake Arrieta. Why?
Because he shaved his beard. Isn't it a little? He looks a lot younger. He does this every offseason. He shaves that big, bushy beard off his face, and he's going clean shaven now for the offseason.
He looks great. He always was, but he's a very handsome fella.
Yeah, he looks better without the beard, I think, but that's his personality on the mound. He likes the beard. Another picture, these were shared by Brittany Arrieta, Jake's wife, a clean-shaven husband and a house for sale in Wrigley. So
yeah,
you may want to connect the dots there.
What could that possibly mean?
Well, he's gone. I don't think he's going to be a Cub anymore.
Yeah, I knew that.
I mean, that's what I meant.
I knew that, Sam. You don't have to call me stupid. Okay, it's 1:57 and I'm out of time. Will you come on my show on Saturday, my friend?
We can do it.
We'll talk about the Chicago Bulls boxing team a little later on, all right?
Okay, you got it.
That's Sam Panionovich, WGN Sports. A couple of things I still want to get to. We haven't talked to because we don't have to, or talked about because we don't have to. The John Kelly who said what last story. And I have for the last week been poo-pooing it as a story that I don't think is all that important or significant. And now I'm changing my tune only slightly, and we'll explain why after 2:30. Mary Schmeek in the Chicago Tribune yesterday had a page one story that began this way. The night the madness ended, Matthew McFarland had decided that he needed just a little more crack to carry him through until morning. He had plenty of heroin in the small suburban condo he shared with his mother and his fiancée, Amy, but he wanted cocaine, which requires a quick trip to the nearby village of Ford Heights. "No," said Amy when he asked her to drive. They were in their bedroom, where he did drugs out of view of his mother, who knew but could not stand to watch. McFarlane was surprised by Amy's response. "So was she," wrote Mary Schmeek, in the beginning of a what would be, if you printed it out, 14-page story. My goodness, Mary Schmeek, what
Don't
a story.
Don't deter people, John.
Oh, that's right. It's like two pages. It's
it
a quick read.
Easily.
I couldn't stop reading. And frankly, when I got to the end, in fact, when I turned it the final page in the Tribune last night, I realized there was still a lot of story to tell, but I thought, oh, I want to know more. I don't think it was too long. If anything, it was too short. There are so many angles to this story. But at the end of the day, it's the story of Matt, who is addicted to drugs and how it affected him and his family, including his stint in jail and what's happened to him since. Thank you for doing that. If you do not subscribe to a newspaper already, today would be a good day to start just to read this. How did you first discover this story? How did you discover Matt?
I got an email from someone who works for Judge Timothy Evans, who's the chief judge of the Cook County Circuit Court. And, he said, we have a success story out of our drug court, and maybe you'd be interested in this for a column. And it took us a few weeks to kind of work through that. And I said, well, you know, I would like to know more about who this person is. And so he wrote me a little bit more about Matthew. And I could see just from what he wrote that Matthew had a very complicated, fascinating life story. I was still thinking that it was going to be like a 750-word column. And then I went to meet Matthew and Judge Ramon Ocasio, who was the drug court judge, out in the Maywood courthouse. And it turned out that his mother, that Matthew's mother and fiance, showed up as well. And we sat there for 2.5 hours as Matthew told me his story, his travels through drugs in Chicago. And, you know, the mom, Bev, talked, and Amy talked, and the judge talked, and then I realized, oh, this is so much more than this 2.5 hours, so much more.
And it's a story that, if you have not read it, you might imagine, okay, he's in and out of drugs, it affects the family, et cetera. Yes to all of that. I think it's a particularly poignant story because of their circumstances. It's your story is unique to you, and everybody has a unique story, but I think a lot of people can relate. I think
right.
There's a lot of families that are living a version of this, and we all know them, and it's just tragic. It's and it usually ends differently than this one too, I might add.
Right. I mean, the emails that I've been getting are so many of them from families who say, yes, we've had to deal with this, you know, my brother, my father, my cousin.
So Matt is in our studio. Matt, welcome to the studio, and just welcome in general. What a story.
Thanks, John. It's good to be here.
You read the story. What was your reaction?
Well, I'll tell you, there was a lot leading up to the story. It was a lot of interviewing. I believe it went on for about 3 months. I didn't know it was going to be as revealing. I'm going through what I've later found in that they call in one of the 12-step support groups for friends and families of people like myself, a vulnerability hangover. And I knew the day that Mary said, hey, is there any way you could take us to the west side to see where you used to do what you used to do, that this thing was going to be a little deeper. I didn't know how deep it was going to actually be on paper until I actually really saw it in print, which was the early edition on Saturday. I made sure to run out.
You went out and got the Sunday paper early.
But, you know, I did go through everything
yes.
with you,
yes.
Matthew, because it felt important to me that he and his mom and Amy all know what was going to be in public, because they had no obligation to speak to me, none whatsoever. I mean, this was a gift, right? To tell this story and to tell it true, for them to tell it as truly as they did to me. This is a gift to anyone who is trying to understand what drug addiction looks like, what drugs in Chicago look like. So, you know, I just wanted to discuss with him. And I have to say, Matthew, I am just, it's very brave to put yourself out that way. And, you know, at one point, I don't know if you remember this, but, you know, I told you that. You know, I knew you were nervous. You were nervous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you said the truth is in the details. And it's true.
It is.
The truth is in the details. Mm-hmm. And I told you that qualified you for a journalism degree.
To either teach or be a student, right?
But it's hard. I mean, you didn't have to say all that stuff.
Well, let me ask the two of you this, and Mary, maybe you should take the lead just for brevity's sake, but for the people who didn't read the story, give me the condensed version of what you wrote.
Well, Matthew started dabbling in doing drugs when he was very young.
16, you were doing heroin, right, with your uncle.
Well, I was stealing pills from my father, who was a pharmaceutical salesman at the age of 9, actually. I was really a young boy.
Were you consuming drugs at 9?
I was. I was
to
experimenting.
Get high? Yeah,
no, I was very much experimenting, like the colors, as the article talks about it. They look like candy, all the different colors of the rainbow. To me, I felt like I had came across a bag of Skittles, which seemed to be very important to my dad and some of his colleagues at the time. So,
but then, you know, from the age of 9 on, 13 stealing Valium from his grandfather, 16 doing heroin and coke with his uncle. And by the time he was in his 20s, he was, you know, out on the South Side in squalid buildings and with homeless people and, you know, just doing drugs all the time. And
supported by your mom all the time.
Supported, my mother, you know, her intention was to help. And I think a lot of parents and families of people that are addicted are just trying to help, and they don't know the best way to help. So it's a
very
complex.
Want to abandon you. She felt you were the underdog compared to your brother. She could relate a little bit personally, and so she was always trying to help you out of your circumstances. In retrospect, did you and your mom talk about this and say, "Mom, you should have cut me off sooner"? I know what she would probably say. I would afraid you would have gotten killed if I hadn't continued to bail you out or take you in. But what's that conversation go like now?
Well, I think that you have to look at it through the lens of somebody who has a son or a daughter who's struggling with that. And certainly from my mother's lens, it was what she had always told other people, because she continually got that advice, right? Cut them off, kick them out, throw them out. But when it's your son, right, it changes it. It changes the dynamic substantially. And so my mother just, you know, would reply to those individuals, "Well, if it was your son or daughter, what would you do?"
Yeah, so she suffered a lot. You know, there was the suffering that she felt of watching what was happening to you, the social stigma involved in trying to help you. But then, you know, at some point, and then things got very, 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 very bad, and you wound up in prison.
Correct.
And in prison, you got clean.
I did.
And then you were clean for 8 years.
I was.
For 8 years, and then what happens?
Well, then there was the paradigm. It was kind of like a three things kind of came together. My father died. The mother of my daughter had a relapse and disappeared out of my life. I couldn't get a hold of her, didn't know where my daughter was. I was diagnosed with hepatitis C, had pretty bad liver damage, and so I started treating myself for that disease via interferon, I believe it's called. And I used to have to give myself shots in the leg. And
I was really mad at the doctor for prescribing that.
Yeah, I went
no,
to...
No, it's the Xanax.
It's the Xanax, actually. I went to the doctor. See, the crazy thing about this whole disease concept is that it doesn't matter, right? We have a physical allergy to mind and mood-altering substances, and whether it's prescribed by a doctor, right, wearing a lab coat, or whether it's given to you by some guy on the streets, your body reacts to it the same way, and so... When the doctor prescribed me Xanax.
So you went to a doctor. You had these things converge in your life, and you really felt like you were on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Correct. I was.
So you went to the doctor.
Yes.
And he prescribed Xanax.
He prescribed me.
And he knew, though, that you were an ex-junkie, right?
He did, yes. In fact, I remember actually getting into an argument with him about it and saying, you know, I don't think Xanax is a real smart idea. And in fact, I argued with him about another medication, and he said that you have to give me a benzodiazepine, can we make it something that's less addictive? And he argued with me, and I remember him looking at me saying, "I'm the doctor here. Let me make these decisions." And so I left the doctor's office literally with a prescription for Xanax, and ironically the Walgreens was right directly across the street, and so I left my you know, I left the doctor's office, got in my car, drove directly across the street to the Walgreens, and as the story says, it was kind of crazy how the mind fools itself into thinking, "Hey, the doctor gave me this, maybe it's okay."
Well, you had a great line. You said you made a conscious but not rational decision.
Correct.
Well, you took this knowing even as you did it, as you swallowed, that you were really. A word we can't print.
Right.
Yeah.
You screwed up.
Right.
But you know, I and when I read that, I thought, okay, because you took the two pills and you don't know if now you're going to get re-addicted. But it almost, didn't you end up consuming the whole bottle right then and there?
I did. And by the time
in the parking lot at Walgreens.
No, I actually, after I took the two pills, I walked around the aisles for a little bit thinking how screwed I kind of was for that decision and what a bad decision it was, and ended up just taking the whole bottle because the doom and gloom set in right away. I'm in trouble now.
Thinking, 8 years of sobriety gone in the aisles of a Walgreens,
yeah. And not just that, but 8 years, when you say 8 years of sobriety, it's more than just abstinence. It's the, you know, it's the employment, the career you built up.
Yeah, so you built
family,
a very successful life.
Yeah.
So what happens... So then you were high the next day and the next day and the next day?
I stayed high literally from that point. I did not draw a sober breath, except for the occasion, well, not actually more than occasional instances where I was in and out of jail, which got to be pretty routine. But I didn't, and when I was out of jail, I didn't draw a sober breath literally until December 9th, which was my first day of continuous.
So how many years was that then from that moment?
That would have been at least about 3 years. Three. Yeah, about 3 years.
Fast forward then to how did you get out of that spiral?
Well, you know, I think it was a unique combination of the criminal justice system, treatment interventions, you know, and employment opportunities with my current employer that kind of gave the holistic, you know, because, you know, I was telling Mary, I said, you know, there's a lot of people that get their parts right, right? I mean, there's a criminal justice system, I think, that certainly has its place. The clinical interventions, the treatment that people provide, I think, has its place. But I think all too often we overlook the importance of employment, because I remember as I was going through that drug court scenario, my biggest worry was, you know, this is great. I got, you know, while I got the support, what do I do when it's over? What am I going to do?
Yeah.
And the answer came in the form of employment and finding a purpose, you know, a reason to get up in the morning.
I was in reading the story. So Matthew McFarland is in our studio along with Mary Schmeek. Mary wrote Matthew's story in the Chicago Tribune yesterday, Matt versus the Monster. What an apt title. An addict's unlikely redemption.
The monster being addiction, right? I mean, that comes from a quote in the story from the drug court judge that Matthew appeared in front of. You know, he said that when he first saw Matthew, he thought he could be, you know, he could see his intelligence, he could see his capacities if he could only get rid of the monster called addiction.
And that was the thing that there's so many tragic moments in the story, and then there's some that I just go, yes, yes. And one was, I did not realize that the courts, the bureaucracy, could be as sympathetic and smart as it came across to me. Mary, I didn't know there was a sort of an effort to help these people reclaim. I just thought we were throwing the key away on some folks.
No, there's a system of problem-solving courts within the Cook County system. And there's one for drug court, there's mental health court, and there's veterans court. And the whole idea is that when you take nonviolent offenders who, you know, have gotten into the prison or the jail system because of something that involves mental health, that involves, I don't actually know how the veterans court works, but involves drug possession, that, you know, there's got to be a better way of dealing with them. It costs, I never put this in the story, but I meant to, it costs like $24,000 to keep someone incarcerated for a year. So why not help them get clean and
right,
then help them go back out into the world? You know, with the understanding, you know, I've received a couple of emails that make, I think, a fair point.
Hold on right there.
Yeah.
Finish that thought in a minute. Matthew, stay right there, too. It's 2:22. Yeah, I am interested in the reaction to this story. I'll bet it's been pronounced. Coming up here on WGN, Mary Schmeek's Sunday page one story in the Chicago Tribune was titled Matt versus the Monster, an addict's unlikely redemption. It's the story of Matthew McFarland. In our studio, Mary, we were talking, both of you. Matt, I appreciate you being here. We've got just a minute or two left, Mary, but we were talking about the response. Maybe both of you could respond to that. What have you been reading? You were talking about some email, right?
Well, I mean, I'd say most of my email has been either from people who have a family member who is struggling with addiction. I had a few from people who say, you know, I'm an addict myself, and I love this story because that's my life. It feels real. I feel like there are a lot of stories about addiction out there that never really address the full spectrum of everything. And that's partly what Matthew and I were trying to get at with this. You know, I've heard from a couple people who say they don't believe in 12-step programs and that this seemed to promote the idea of 12-step programs when 12-step programs don't work. The point of my story was not really to get into what works and what doesn't. It was to tell this story about Matthew McFarland, who, you know, has been clean for almost 2 years now. And Matthew, you know as well as anyone, you were just saying, this is day by day, day by day. It's every day for the rest of your life.
Yeah. When your eyes open up in the morning, do you think, okay, I got to go to battle again, or is it easier now?
It's easier not to to know that I'm not behind the wheel driving the car, right? I mean, so as I said in the story in the interview, that an addict alone is in bad company. So I keep surrounded by people with long-term sobriety that are working good programs. And I will say this, is that 12-step programs don't have the monopoly on recovery. They certainly don't. The only thing I would suggest to anybody is get in where you can, right? Whatever does work for you. But I'll tell you what, one of the things that is needed, I think, is a critical component, is having a purpose, finding a purpose in life, whatever that is, a passion. Be passionate. Find something you want to do. For me, it was, you know, working with other people as I do in my job now. And some of the feedback I've gotten so far has been a lot of people asking some of the same questions that they asked Mary, but a lot of people asking for help and employment for people.
Clarify, I mean, before we go, I'd like to make it clear what Matthew's doing now, right?
Yeah, sure.
You're working at the Safer Foundation, which is a big Chicago not-for-profit that works to stabilize people once they've gotten out of prison. People with records, right? And so, you know, Matthew started there in a temp position when he got out of jail.
Right,
started
right.
in a temp position, worked himself up quickly to a job matching people with career jobs, with good jobs. And now he is helping with this new program that coordinates the specialty courts, the problem-solving courts out of the Cook County system, funneling people from those courts into Safer, where they're going to get help finding jobs. So they're not just, so you get clean in drug court and then you're tossed back out into the world. So
that's where Safer intervenes. The unique thing about this situation is that as a result of my experience with the drug courts, as I was going back talking to my leadership team at Safer, telling them how badly it's needed employment opportunities for people, they said, go engage them, find out. And so we were able to secure some funding, and we're using that funding now to engage the Circuit Court of Cook County, specifically the specialty courts or problem-solving courts, to address the situation, the same very one that I found myself in, to help people with career opportunities.
You said in the to us just now here on the radio, an addict alone is in bad company, and Mary mentions that in the very end of her writing about you. An addict alone is bad company. You're only as sick as your secrets. Stay sober and carry the message. Every morning after he makes his coffee and lights a cigarette, he kneels down next to the living room couch, puts his hands together, looks up and says, good morning, God, reporting for duty. And I just thought, oh, hooray for all of that. I'm so happy to meet you. Keep doing what you're doing, Matthew. And Mary, keep doing what you're doing. What a well-told story.
Thank you, John. Yeah. Thank you, Matthew.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
And thanks to your mom.
Yeah. Hi, Mom. Hi, Amy out there.
I want to interview your mom and Amy. I'm so glad there was a picture of them in the paper, too, Mary, because you mentioned them a lot. They're a big part of your life. They're a big part of the story and for obvious reasons. And they look great. I saw them smiling in the picture. And you know, I hope that you all...
Can I add one last thing? There's a guy I mentioned in this story. His name's Ray. And he's actually... you know, I talked to him, I dropped off a newspaper, as I did this morning to Judge Ocasio, and we embraced and had some good laughs about some of the past. But Ray starts a job through Safer actually tomorrow.
And this was a guy that I used to do drugs with on the west side.
Yeah. And he's really excited. He starts a job tomorrow.
Ray is a great guy.
He is. He's working with Safer Foundation now. We got him a job, and he starts tomorrow, and he's really excited about that. And he was in tears, actually. When he heard about the opportunity and accepted it. So there is hope at the end of the road.
Yesterday's paper, Matt versus the Monster, an addict's unlikely redemption. Thank you both. It's 2:31 on WGN. Steve, I think you and I were disagreeing a little bit last week about what box to put the General Kelly, Frederico Wilson, Donald Trump story in.
I'm interested that you're changing because so am I.
Here are two thought ships passing in the night. So my attitude all last week was that this is just another example of the president being disingenuous or even delusional, but we have plenty of those. So however this story resolves itself, you're not going to learn anything that you didn't already know. We don't need to spend so much energy hating Donald Trump or defending Donald Trump. We should say, okay, he gave a speech or he made a phone call. It went badly. End of story. But we didn't do that, did we? We're still talking about it today. that's where I was. You were in a different place. Why are you changing your view? You were constantly reminding me that if we let any of these...
If my issue is that what has... And I keep using the word extraordinary because what the president's behavior is extraordinary in that it never happens with others. So if we stop pointing out when he is untruthful or when he behaves in a way that is unprecedented, then it starts to become normal. And if we want it to be normal, that's a way to do it. If we don't want it to be normal, we have to continue to point it out because there's still, is a sizable portion of us who thinks it is acceptable or it is normal. It's certainly their right. But
or that he's telling the truth
and we can't
all the
just,
time.
Yeah. Right, that the media is picking on him. So I think if we stop because we say, well, he's just doing it again, then it becomes normal.
Yeah. So how has your position on that changed a little?
Well, just the fact that this ugly, destructive, partisan garbage is now centered around the death of a soldier is so discouraging to me. And I don't know at what moment I would have undone something. But this, to quote General Kelly, we played it on your show last week, this should be sacred, and damn them all for stopping that or for interfering with that. I'm not saying that we shouldn't know any of it. I don't know which of it I wouldn't report, because I think much of it is significant. Even General Kelly now clearly said something, seemingly said something that was untrue in referring to this congresswoman as a quote-unquote empty barrel. Everybody is stained by it, and it's just so discouraging.
Well, that's why I've changed my tune. It's on that point. I think it's just emblematic of how not only willing the president is to lie, but his agents are as well. And that's the real danger, right? Because at some point they're going to tell us we have to go to war with North Korea. And I think we have to be able to trust them. But since we can't trust them about a short phone call, then how can we trust them about the larger things? If they're willing to lie about the trivial, then what happens when it's something that really does matter?
Do you think General Kelly intentionally was lying last week? Excuse me.
Okay, I'm going to say yes, just because that's all the evidence I have in front of me. I hate that, but clearly, if he saw this, I watched the speech again today that Frederica Wilson gave when they dedicated the FBI building and named it after two agents who fell in the line of duty. Five others were severely injured. So it's this dedication ceremony.
Right.
There's Frederick, and General Kelly described that as an appalling display of ego where she made it about herself.
That she got the funding for the building.
And I watched the whole 10-minute speech. I literally annotated it with time marks next to each paragraph. And it's nothing of the kind.
Now, the White House says she said things at other times of the day.
Okay, well, I guess maybe. I'm just telling you, I watched that speech. He was referring to that speech, at least it sure seemed to be. And it was a terrific speech. It gave Marco Rubio credit, and it spoke a lot about the agents. And let me just finish this thought.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
To the degree that she gives herself credit, it's that they said, listen, to name this building will take 8 months to a year, maybe a year and a half. And she said, well, I'm an old high school principal. And I said, give this to me. I'll get it done. And then she gave it to John Boehner. And John Boehner, she said, was a pit bull for this thing. And Marco Rubio went to bat for this thing. And we all got it done. And yeah, she's telling the story through her lens. But she tells it in a way I thought that was encompassing. And by the way, the whole part of that where she describes how she was a central figure in getting it named, and she was, takes about a minute and a half in a 10-minute speech, the rest of which is about other people, including the agents. That's the speech that Kelly rolled his eyes at, called her an empty barrel, and said it was all about her.
The speech, if that was what he was talking about,
if that's what he was talking about,
characterized that way.
Absolutely.
But it's hard for me to, we played it Thursday, I think. The emotion of him saying he was so bothered by all of this that he went and walked among the tombstones at Arlington. How in the very preceding breath he could knowingly lie about what she said at that speech, I can't put that together.
Well,
that's too hard for me to believe.
Soledad O'Brien, over the weekend, tweeted an article from, this is how I happened to fall upon it, it was either the New York or the New York Times, and it said, what a shame that General Kelly has fallen into the duplicitous orbit of Donald Trump. Trump makes people like this. If you're with him, you have to do you got to do his work, and that means you've got to either obfuscate or lie or marginalize. I mean, whatever Kelly was doing was not a fair representation.
And you talk about making things normal. You know, he was he was referring to a member of Congress as an empty barrel.
Yeah.
Again,
I don't know that phrase.
That's a White House chief of staff saying that about a member of Congress. That's the sort of stuff that never happened. Now, that's so minor, it doesn't even get much attention paid to it.
Well, so there's Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying we should respect the generals. She backed off of this a little bit because she said we should respect General Kelly's sensitivity to his son. Not all of them are beyond reproach, but she said, I think in some of these instances, we should respect the generals. So you know what happens then? They get the video of Donald Trump on the campaign trail running the generals down, saying how dumb they were, the mistakes they made, et cetera, et cetera. And then the president and his spokesperson, who are calling for a measure of dignity, is there in a he said, she said argument with the widow of the soldier that we're talking about.
He called essentially a Gold Star widow a liar today on Twitter.
Absolutely. I know.
I mean, that's essentially what he did.
So that's where you are today. So all of this silliness, we're sort of not surprised anymore by the president.
Can I say one other thing, though?
Sure.
Just because of that. I mean, typically a president, even if he believes that, wouldn't make that accusation. I heard, I don't know if it was over the weekend or last week, a former Bush aide. Remember Cindy Sheehan? Was living outside the president's President Bush's Crawford Ranch. Her son had died.
Oh yeah. She was a pit bull.
And the Bush aide, you know, the president did not meet with her. The president had met with her in a group before, and apparently was moved to tears in the meeting. But while she's out there ripping the president day after day, this aide said there were discussions with the president in the highest level about making sure she had food and water and everything she needed during her protest. You know, that's the level of respect they gave someone who was absolutely excoriating them every day.
And had a national spotlight on her because of it. Soledad O'Brien, it was a New Yorker headline. John Kelly is the latest victim of a president who sullies the reputation of those who work with and for him. And I thought, okay, so how could the president have extricated himself and not drawn John Kelly into this? And he hates it that this, and by the way, don't think for a minute that one of the reasons that they are running Frederica Wilson down on this is because she looks goofy. She wears those glasses and hats, and it's very easy to marginalize and make fun of Frederica Wilson. And so the president puts her out, her as the Daffy Democrat. He's got a nickname for her now. It's not that, but it's something like that. Boy, that's a level of respect that not everybody gets, right? When the president deigns to give you a nickname, you know you've gotten under his skin. This, the widow of the soldier who died in Niger. So what could the president have said? He could have said this. No one can know the pain that she is going through. I am sorry my best intention fell short. And I wish her and family the very best. What a great tweet that would have been. Why couldn't Sarah have said that or somebody have said that? I cannot imagine the pain she's going through. I'm sorry my best intention fell short. Doesn't that meet everybody in the middle somehow? And wish her and family the very best. And then go on and do taxes. He can't do that. And I'll just wrap this up with this thought, Steve. I mean, the reason I bring it back up again today is because we are going to count on these people to tell us the truth about the consequences of taxes or health care or whether or not we should, you know, turn North Korea into glass. And I'm hard-pressed to... And I thought Kelly was like a stand-up guy.
Well, you know what?
And I hate that I now doubt his integrity.
Maybe some of that's our fault, too, because we create things in our mind. Right. Well, you know, it's like, oh, General Kelly will take care of him. Well, we didn't know anything from General Kelly.
No, but we knew he was a 4-star general.
Yeah.
He was a no-nonsense guy.
And we know he was certainly, you know, suffered a great loss in the military. But
I thought he would be the guy that would tell Donald Trump, no, we're not going to do it that way.
That's because we hoped there would be someone to do that. Maybe he is. Maybe he still is, too.
It's 2:50. Pause. You can join us. You can text. You can call. 312-981-7200. Hey, happy Monday. When I get to be king someday, that fast-talking gibberish at the end, they won't have to do that. That's not helpful to anybody. A text has just poured in. John, fascinating speech by Teddy Roosevelt about Mein Kampf regarding lying. You should find that and play it. It's very appropriate now. A couple quick phone calls here. Mary, you're on WGN. What did you want to say? Hi.
Okay, I'm just responding to your conversation. Nobody addresses the fact that this congresswoman was overhearing a somewhat private conversation, and she had no qualms about recording it and making it public. And what do you think she wanted to do? What were her intentions?
No, she didn't record it, and I don't know what her intentions were.
What do you mean she didn't? Well, where
didn't
do you
record
think she got it?
She heard it and reported it. That's the problem. It's one person's version of it versus another. There's no tape of that phone call, and that's why she and the president say each of the other is lying. I don't know what her intention was, but she knew the soldier. She knew that young man. She knows the family. I don't know how they were all together, but it didn't strike me as terribly illogical that they would be. Was she driven
really?
By partisan politics? Maybe so. I don't know. I don't know that that changes the...
I don't think that's a maybe, John. Would you ever think about making something public when you have a friend who has lost a husband or a child? Would you ever in your mind think about sharing that with the world? I would not.
Yeah.
I think the sense of decency would make you not. And then in all of the angst and everything now that's still being talked about, the whole thing is lost. I mean, do I think it was partisan? Of course I think it was partisan. There isn't anything that happens that isn't.
Yeah.
I think we all know that.
Boy, these days you may be right about that. I appreciate your phone call. Thanks for listening and thanks for calling. I'm going to go from you real quick to Kevin online too. Kevin, you had an interpretation of that story. What was that?
Hey there, John. Great show. I love your the variety of your topics.
Thank you.
All right. So the analogy of the empty barrel. So let's picture a vineyard. There's two wooden barrels up on racks. One is full of wine. One is basically empty. The rack tips over. The empty barrel comes down with a huge bang, and it just breaks apart. The barrel that is full and full of substance and knowledge comes down, and if it bangs to the ground, it makes a much smaller noise. And that's the analogy of somebody with an empty barrel. They need to do something within their lives to fill who they are.
And that's what John Kelly said Frederica Wilson is. And do you concur with that? Do you think that was an appropriate description of her then?
I don't, you know what, John, I'm going to be like you. I don't know enough about her. What I've seen about her since then, I think she needs to be a little bit more humble. You know, humility is wonderful, especially representing people.
Yeah, Kevin, I'm going to cut you short because I'm out of time, but I agree with you. I think she and he should both stop talking about this now, even if each of them feels like they have the high ground. I don't think that young man's memory is served by us all arguing about who was lying about it the first or the most. Elif did find this. Many credit Plato for bringing empty barrel into the vernacular. An empty vessel makes the loudest sound. That's your point, exactly. So that they have the least wit and are the greatest blabbers, said Plato. And John Kelly, and now all of us. Rokon and Anna DeVlantis are in the studio.
Hi, John.
Campers.
Hello.
Hello.
What's the highlight of?
I don't know.
What are you most excited about today, Ro?
I don't.
On a dreary Monday.
I don't know. I'm
Tell
trying.
Me, do something about rainbows, sunshine, lollipops.
Unicorns. We should talk unicorns.
I'm trying to.
Even candy corns. I love candy corns.
Right now, you know what they did is I got, it was really weird. I spent most of the weekend in the trunk of a car. Tied up. Yeah. And by our own production staff, because they didn't want me to go on my phone and look at social media or look at the push notifications. And they just put me in here right now, and I looked at my phone, and I've looked at the last weekend's push notifications, and I
what a service they did to you.
Yeah, now I'm having a stress reaction, not believing what I'm looking at.
They kind of saved you from yourself for the weekend.
We had some friends over Saturday night, so I was away from my phone as I should be. And then I stole a glance at it. And a friend of mine in Minnesota who works in the radio, and she's Jewish, and she goes, "Donald, Shabbat already. Give it a break." And I thought, oh, I'm missing some good stuff. And it really wasn't any more than the usual. He's mad at the media and Frederica Wilson and Democrats.
Right. And
waging a war with the Gold Star family.
Right. And now the Gold Star family just doesn't seem to be able. And I his instinct is always to defend himself no matter what. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just, you know, when you have a grieving widow, you just kind of let the grieving widow say, "Did you ever see Jaws? Remember that scene where the mom comes up on the dock and she slaps the police chief, right? Chief Brody, because the boy got eaten by the shark and it wasn't his fault."
No.
Sometimes you just got to take it. Sometimes you just got to take it.
Well, you know, Mammy really shouldn't have been in that. Bam!
Just shut up. Let her hit you.
He knew what he was getting into by getting into the water.
I want to point, right.
High five. Adam.
And the dog, too. And the black lab, too. Oh, man. Hey, I want to point out, you know, it's interesting you bring up the thing about Shabbat, you know, the Sabbath between Friday night sundown and Saturday night sundown. Sometimes he does his best tweeting in that period of time because his daughter's unable to use her phone.
Mm-hmm. Can't advise him.
They can't, and the son-in-law can't, she can't be like, "Hey, Dad, stop it."
I never thought about that.
Yeah.
Maybe we've sort of uncovered some of the method.
I believe there is some. That Friday overnight is always a big one.
Here's what I want somebody to go. I was going to Google this today. I was going to go, "Aleph, Google this." what gets the most likes and what doesn't? Because I'm always looking at his likes, comments, and retweets, and I'm like, I'll bet that there's some, you know, measure of like, what are the, like Hillary stuff always blows up for him.
So he's doing it on his, but he's also reacting. Something we don't realize. He's sometimes reacting to other people when he's tweeting. Somebody in his, you know, in his line of tweets has already said something or provoked him, or somebody he's following has provoked him into doing something, and he's responding. It's not always what's on Fox News Channel. Sometimes what's somebody else is reacting to that was on Fox News Channel or that was on something else. And then you know, he immediately goes into heavy defense mode. But, you know, it was all fine when I was tied up in the back of the car. Fine. It's not fine anymore.
Does it help, though, when you get to take them all in at once rather than periodically throughout a weekend?
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe it's better. I mean, you have really a bad moment, but dang, you had a good weekend.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah. All right, here we are.
Bye now.